History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In early American history, one of the most admired nations by the founding fathers was, believe it or not, Iran. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams wrote with admiration about Iran, or at least in its historical form, quoting passages from the Old Testament in which Iran protected its Jewish population, or how leaders like Cyrus the Great provided for equality of all of his subjects in ancient Persia and the Achaemenid Empire and later empires. As the United States grew in power in Iran, had positive relationships because Iran viewed the United States as a Western nation that wasn't trying to control it or make it a colonial subject the way that Russia and Britain and other European powers were. Later on in the 19th century, many American Presbyterian missionaries built hospitals and schools in Iran, and while some Iranians didn't like their attempts to convert them to Christianity, many of them appreciated the social services they provided to the nation. In World War II, Iran was seen as an important ally, and America wanted to build it up and build up its democracy in the Cold War. So what happened? Why did the U.S. and Iran have perhaps the worst relations among any two nations on Earth? Many would point to the 1953 CIA-backed coup against a democratically elected government in Iran, or the 1979 Islamic Revolution and the takeover of the U.S. embassy. To untangle all this, today I'm joined with John Gazvinian. He is the author of the new book, America and Iran, A History, 1720 to the Present. He's also an Iranian-born, Oxford-educated historian who teaches this subject, and has drawn on years of archival research both in the United States and Iran, including access to Iranian government archives rarely available to Western scholars. So what he does is, in this discussion, leads us through the four seasons of U.S.-Iran relations. The spring of mutual fascination the two nations held with each other, the summer of early interactions, the autumn, as he says, of close strategic ties, and the long dark winter of mutual hatred. So what he argues is that the two nations once had heartfelt admiration for each other, how they became enemies, and how it doesn't have to turn out this way and they can become friends once again. This is sort of an unexplored corner of history, but I think looking at these corners helps us paint in the edges and understand the wider picture of what's going on. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with John Gazvinian. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I'm very excited to discuss this topic. I seem to say that a lot of my episodes, but I don't get to typically talk with an expert on Persia, and I came across it a lot in my research because I'm a historian in the Middle East. Very important state, very important empire for thousands of years, and the way that Iran is understood in the 21st century is due to not just things that happened in the 20th century, but there's a long history behind it. So there are many ways that we could start this off, but I suppose for you as a historian of Iran and as an instructor, when you talk about it, what are things that surprise people the most based on their limited understanding of Iran, just based on, I don't know, the CIA overthrow in the 1950s or the revolution in the 1979 or the other contemporary events?
Yeah, I think you're right that we do tend to stay very much in the present moment whenever we talk about Iran and about U.S.-Iran relations. I think, unfortunately, this is a topic that people immediately associate with kind of recent tensions and, you know, day-to-day news items. And to the extent that, you know, we do look at the history, people tend to use history as a weapon, as a kind of stick to beat their enemies with and to sort of cast blame and look for victims and oppressors. And I think that's an really unfortunate way of looking at history. You know, the thing about the history of U.S.-Iran relations that really surprised me, and I think surprises most people probably who read the book, will surprise most people who read the book, is just how warm and positive and friendly these relations were and for just how long. Not just warm and positive, but there was a really long history of mutual fascination, mutual admiration, even a kind of mutual idealization between these two countries for a really long time that really makes the last 40 years almost seem like a kind of blip on the history of this relationship. You know, you mentioned 1953 and 79, and of course, your readers who, or your listeners, excuse me, who are more familiar with this history will think of those two seminal dates, right? Of course, the 1979 hostage crisis in Iran that was associated with the revolution that overthrew the Shah, the pro-American Shah, and replaced his rule with an Islamic Republic. And in the process, you know, radicalized students who were angry about the admission of the Shah, the former Shah, into the U.S. by the Carter administration, overtook the U.S. embassy and took employees hostage for over a year. In many ways in the U.S., that is kind of ground zero, if you will, a sort of original sin, the beginning of this kind of negative story. For many Iranians, of course, 1953 is that moment, right? The moment when the recently created Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, in the U.S. overthrew a very popular prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, in Iran. Because they were convinced by the British that he was potentially going to destabilize the country. But really, they were very concerned about, the British were concerned about maintaining their control over the oil industry in Iran. For a lot of Iranians, that's where the problem begins. But, you know, you can immediately see the problem in this way of framing the question, right? Because what you're doing here is you're looking for who's at fault. Whose fault is it? Where did this start? Who started it? Yeah, and these are, I don't think, really good ways to approach history, because I think history is not a blame game. It's not a competitive sport. And I think that when you look at the deeper and richer history, you start to appreciate, you know, how it hasn't always been this way and how it doesn't need to be this way. I think the point I often try to make is, you know, as historians of U.S.-Iran relations, we're called upon to explain how it all went so wrong. But I think embedded in that question, implicit in that question, is a more interesting question, which is, how did it all go so right? If you're assuming that it all went wrong, then at some point you're implying that it all went right. Or did it? Was there a golden age of U.S.-Iran relations? Those are some of the questions I try to answer in the book.
Right. And the relations are there from the founding of the United States, because Iran obviously predates it by a very long time. And you mentioned that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams looked with admiration at Persia. What was the government of Persia at this time, and why did these founding fathers admire it?
Yeah, and I want to be very careful, actually, to not create the impression that the founding fathers admired contemporary Persia or Iran. They didn't know much about Iran in the late 18th, early 19th century, as it actually existed, as it actually was. They knew a lot about the ancient Persian Empire. And of course, you know, Iran has had many, many empires, many incarnations of the so-called Persian Empire, starting with the Achaemenians, you know, in the 6th century BC and going through the Safavids in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. They were really enamored about a certain idea they had of Persia and of ancient Persia. They had read things like the Cyropaedia, which was a book written by 4th century BC Greek historian Xenophon about the Persian Empire. They'd read Herodotus, and they knew that, you know, the Greeks, although they were enemies of the Persians, actually really admired the Persians. And so, and really, you know, Cyrus, the great Cyrus, the emperor of Persia, was a really admired figure in early America, in the early American Republic. You know, there are biblical reasons why people liked him. You know, he's presented very positively in the Bible, Ezra book, chapter 1, for freeing the Jews from the Babylonian captivity. You know, he's seen as this kind of benevolent despot who, you know, gave rights to religious minorities and was, you know, was kind of not a dictator. Whether or not this is true, it's actually almost irrelevant, and I'm not really qualified to assess that. But what's just as interesting is just the impression that they had of the Persian Empire. That there was a sort of benevolent empire. You could see why that might have been appealing to some of the founding fathers, who knew that they were undertaking this new mission, to lead this new republic over this very large geographic territory. You know, they didn't think of themselves as an empire, but they did think of themselves as, you know, creating this new republic. And what were the models they were looking to? Well, of course, the Greeks and the Romans. That's something we know about quite a bit. But I think they were also very interested in Persia. You know, we know that Jefferson read the Cyropaedia very carefully because he owned two copies. And he, you know, his handwriting is there in the margins where he notices the difference between the two copies. We know that John Quincy Adams was told by his mother, Abigail Adams, to read the Cyropaedia and learn from the example of Cyrus for how to govern a nation. You know, these are things that I think are not always well known to Americans who know that early history and who think of the Greco-Roman heritage.
And just as a quick aside, I've mentioned on this podcast before Jack Weatherford's book, Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World, because the Founding Fathers make some reference to the Mongols. He runs with that wildly and credits essentially the Mongols with the founding of the American Republic. And he basically credits the Mongols with everything short of the moon landing, although he might credit them with that too. But you don't run that wild and you know your limits. So anyway, as a quick aside, it's always good to not go too crazy with references here and there by famous people. I'm curious what Persia's impression of the United States was, because for many groups around the world, particularly revolutionary groups, they looked positively at the United States because they have a revolution. Against all reasonable expectation, it succeeds against a much stronger power. they're able to enact incredible reform and give rights to those who historically did not have them. So it's a model by many groups, although there are a number of factors that make it work in the United States that don't elsewhere. Not without getting into all that, what's the impression in Persia of the United States?
That's exactly right. Yeah, I think that this is so. So initially, the Iranians are not terribly interested in the United States. They don't know that much about it. Some of the very first books that I've seen that have been published in Persian about America, that touch on America, are actually published in Calcutta in the British Empire, but in Persian, that would have probably been read in Iran, you know, and they have some interesting observations. You know, they refer to it as the Yengi Donya, the New World. They even have observations about race and race relations in the North America. There's a quote I came across in one of these books that says, you know, in America, people with dark features and dark hair are treated less well than people who are, you know, fair skinned and have light colored hair, you know, which is interesting. But, you know, for the most part, they don't know much about it. There's a great anecdote from Harford Jones in 1807 or thereabouts, where he visits Fath Ali Shah, the king of Persia at the time. And apparently the Shah says to him, "What is this new world I keep hearing about? You know, where is it? You know, how do you get to it? You know, is it underground?" You know, now, this may be apocryphal. He may never have said that. But, you know, it demonstrates something of the kind of atmosphere in which, you know, early Iranians first thought of America. It was this kind of, you know, terra incognita, this kind of wild land, you know, savages and so on. But a little bit later, Iranians do, particularly in the mid to late 19th century, as they start to feel more and more frustrated by the depredations that are visited upon them by Russia and Britain, especially when they're really frustrated by what they see as a kind of pattern of imperialistic interference in their affairs by the Russians and the British. That's when they start to become really interested in the U.S. Along exactly the lines that you mentioned. They see the U.S. as an anti-imperial power, as a country that came to power, came into being on the back of a sort of revolution against the British Empire, a country that seems not to want to interfere in other countries' affairs, that seems to respect the, or at least understand the trials and tribulations of weaker, smaller countries. Whether the U.S. does or not is actually, again, I think a real question, but in a way, kind of irrelevant, because this is the impression they have of the U.S. The reality is the U.S. just doesn't care about Iran or any part of the world that's not in its immediate backyard. I mean, this is early American history. We know foreign policy is very much isolationist and opposed to entangling alliances in faraway parts of the world where the U.S. has no strategic interests. And Iran is like that, is one of those places. I mean, it might as well be Antarctica as far as the State Department is concerned, and they're just not interested. But that gives the U.S. a certain kind of allure in the minds of this growing generation of Iranian nationalists, because they see how the Russians, the British, even the French, the Belgians take advantage of Iran's weakness. But they don't see that from the U.S. You know, there are Americans living in Iran, they're Presbyterian missionaries, but they're there building clinics and schools and teaching literacy. Obviously, they're also proselytizing, but they seem to be there to kind of help Iran. And most importantly, they're not backed up by their government. There is no U.S. legation in Iran. There's no U.S. embassy, what we would call it today. There's the U.S. simply seems uninterested, and they like this. And so they really start to idealize the U.S. as this kind of hands-off power. Which it more or less is until, you know, the early to mid 20th century. And that's the initial appeal for Iranians with the U.S.
One thing you mentioned there of Presbyterian missionaries, this is an important point. And when I was doing my research on the Ottoman Empire, it was in the late 19th, early 20th century. A lot of the sources came from missionaries, and listeners today might think, oh, why would they be so important? And as you said, in a way, they're the vanguard. They're going out before there are U.S. embassies or state power or anything. They're sort of independent actors that are going up. They're setting up schools, they're setting up hospitals and churches and all these other things, and proselytization, but also education as part of their, you know, post-millennialist eschatology and all these other things. So their relations are really interesting. And they're these missionaries who have connections, sometimes with very high-level connections with Middle East government actors, are the ones who are writing the first dictionaries and doing the first translation between English and Persian, or English and Turkish and other languages. But could you describe that relationship, positive, negative, and how they were intermediaries between the United States and Iran?
Yeah, I think actually the way you just described that is really nice. I'm not sure I can really add to it very much. It's exactly right, I think, that this is the thing that I think, you know, there is a tendency, I think, sometimes, especially among academics, to sort of approach these missionaries with a certain level of distaste. And I understand that because of the sort of proselytizing nature of the mission. Obviously, it's like all things in history, it's complicated. It's not a simple black and white issue. Yes, they are there to convert. Actually, they're not there to convert Muslims or Jews. They're actually technically there to convert Christian Iranians to a quote-unquote better form of Christianity. because they think that by uplifting their position and improving their lives, they will set an example to their Muslim brethren, and therefore millions of people will convert to Presbyterian Christianity across the Middle East. I mean, it's kind of crazy when you look back. Obviously, it never happened. Even today, I mean, you know, after a century of work in Iran, you know, only a few hundred people were ever actually converted among Christians, much less among, you know, Muslims. You know, but I think that the significance of the missionaries is not in their proselytization efforts. I mean, that obviously gives it a certain kind of complex, you know, positionality, and I understand that. But what I think makes them really interesting and important and critical is exactly what you described, this kind of intermediary role that they play in kind of mediating early relations. They are the vanguard. They are the first Americans who really know anything about contemporary Iran. Now, their understanding of contemporary Iran may be slightly skewed and seen through a certain kind of, as you say, millenarian Protestant eschatology. In the early 20th century, that actually morphs into a kind of straight up sort of Aryanism and sort of race theory and you know, seeing Iranians as superior to Arabs and so on. And, you know, well, there's a lot of wishful thinking about how Iranians will be quick to give up Islam because, you know, it doesn't suit their character and their race because they're not Semites and so on. Yeah, there's a lot of that, but, you know, and that makes them, I think, in many ways distasteful to our modern sense of our more contemporary sensibilities. But I think that the role they played is critical because, you know, in many cases, it is the same people. Those missionaries, they mediate and they explain Iran to Americans, but they also explain America to Iranians. And they also shape the Iranian elite in many ways. I mean, large, large numbers of people who would go on to become technocrats in the Pahlavi regime in the mid-20th century in Iran were graduates of American schools. They had gone to missionary schools. The Alborz School in Tehran, which was led for more than 40 years by the Pennsylvania missionary Samuel Jordan, was an institute. It was the most elite, one of the most elite schools in Iran. I mean, everyone wanted to send their kids there and did. And these are the people who went on to become government ministers. But it was also these missionaries who, in many cases, would inform American diplomats who were in Iran. And now there was often a tense and interesting relationship between them as well, because the diplomats didn't like the missionaries very much. Typically, they were a little bit condescending. They sort of thought they kind of did know Iran better than the U.S. diplomats in many cases. And they felt that they had been there longer. There was a symbiotic relationship. They informed a lot of American foreign policy and diplomacy towards Iran. And in many cases, if they were the same people, or it was their kids, you know, it was often sons of missionaries who would become American diplomats or work in the U.S. embassy in Tehran. This is the case right through the 1950s and even into the 60s and 70s before the Iranian Revolution.
Right. I mean, the entire field of Middle Eastern studies, from what I've heard, were started in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Many of them were missionaries or sons of missionaries that spoke at a fluent or essentially native level of Middle Eastern languages, or they would be from ethnic groups that maybe had left the Middle East, like Jewish people, other things like that, who also had native familiarity with these cultures. When you were talking about Iranian race theory and all these things, this leads to Iran's interesting role in World War II. But before getting to that, are there any other things that you'd like to highlight in this early stages of American-Iranian relations that you think are important as we consider contemporary events that listeners would do well to know?
I mean, there's so much. Honestly, I could go on for hours about this. I think actually one of the most interesting aspects of this history is the early history. I think people often think it's not going to be that interesting, but are surprised by how interesting it is. It's I blew my mind, for example, to find colonial American newspapers in the 1720s, the first American newspapers published. Just obsessed with Iran and very, very pro-Iranian because they saw it as a rival to the Ottoman Empire, which they hated. the biblical heritage as well, and all these kinds of things. You know, the first diplomats. You know, how much they loved. I mean, the first Iranian diplomat, for example, in Iran, in the U.S. You know, how much he loved the U.S. and described it as a country that was so perfect. It was it was like a land where everything that that Allah and the Prophet Muhammad wanted to see had come to fruition. I mean, that's how he described the U.S. in his first dispatches back to Tehran. I mean, we could go on and on about this stuff. I mean, there's a really deep, rich history. There were pro-American demonstrations on the streets of Iran in 1919 in response to the kind of Wilsonian moment where they felt that the U.S. was sympathetic to Iran against Britain, even though it really wasn't that sympathetic. But, you know, they got that feeling. I mean, there was U.S. Treasurer General Morgan Schuster, who was sent over to Iran, hired by Iran to reorganize its finances and became a stout defender of Iranian nationalism against the Russians, became a hero to Iranians who, you know, cheered and waved American flags as he left Tehran after the Russians kicked him out. returned to the U.S. and became a celebrity in the U.S. I mean, there was a stampede here in Philadelphia. There was a stampede down Walnut Street, people coming out to hear him speak about Iran. I mean, I just go on and on about this stuff. I mean, there was such a warmth there. There were amusing anecdotes, like in the 1930s, the two countries broke off ties for 3 years because of a dispute that grew out of a speeding ticket that was given to the Iranian ambassador in a small town by the name of Elkton, Maryland.
Oh, wait, please, can you tell that story? That I love things like that. What happened there?
You know, that ended up getting cut. The book, by the way, was originally twice the length that it is today, and you can thank my editors for cutting it down. But one of the many great stories that kind of, I had a whole chapter on this that ended up becoming just a paragraph, sadly. But yeah, no, this was in, you know, this was Thanksgiving, the weekend before Thanksgiving, just before Thanksgiving weekend, the Iranian ambassador, Ghaffar Jalal, was being driven by his American chauffeur with his wife and their Spitz lapdog from Washington to New York. And they were driving a little too fast through Elkton, Maryland. And a policeman came out, jumped out from behind the bushes, blew his whistle, issued a speeding ticket. A loud argument ensued. Apparently, it escalated into a scuffle, somehow involving the Spitz lapdog. And you know, this small town constable didn't understand the concept of diplomatic immunity, so he ended up arresting the Iranian ambassador for several hours, and it escalated into an international incident. It was resolved fairly quickly, but then the American media, the press, got a hold of it, and the tabloids blew it out way out of proportion. Turned it into this long-running affair that went on for several months, where they insulted the Shah and Iran and so on. And I started referring to it as the Elkton affair, or even the L'affaire Elkton, you know, like it's sort of like a Dreyfus affair. It went on for a while, and apparently the Shah was so angry by the way he was being represented that he broke off ties with the U.S. for 3 years until the Roosevelt administration was able to smooth things over.
Never underestimate the vanity of politicians at very high levels. I think that's not clear today, but it's not a new thing. That's really interesting. Well, getting into World War II, Iran plays an interesting role in this war. And for example, the first meeting between Stalin, Roosevelt, and FDR happens in 1943 in Iran. And there's also an assassination attempt against the three by the Germans, which I did a whole big fat series on. But can you tell me about their role in, or Iran's role in World War II, and how the Nazis are trying to use them, lure them to their side through Indo-European propaganda and the Allies as well?
Yeah, Iran had a long history of neutrality, and it tried to maintain that. It tried to maintain it in both world wars. In the First World War, Iran was simply too weak, and it just its declaration of neutrality was simply ignored. It wasn't even officially, you know, swept aside. The major belligerents in the First World War just simply crisscrossed Iranian territory and fought each other on Iranian territory. But by the Second World War, the Iran was in a slightly stronger position and insisted on its neutrality. And for a while, it got away with it. But unfortunately, Iran was very important to the war effort, both because of its oil and also because when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union from the west, Operation Barbarossa cut off Moscow's access to supplies from its allies. The only routes available would have been through the north, through Archangel, very, very difficult routes to be able to get lend-lease supplies from the U.S. and Britain to the Soviet Union. So the Trans-Iranian Railway became a really lucrative possibility for the Allies. And that is when they ended up invading Iran, giving an ultimatum to the Shah and saying, you must end your neutrality and join the Allies or we will, you know, or else, basically. And he, you know, stood his ground, and the British and the Soviets invaded Iran, and, you know, it took them 3 weeks to defeat the Iranian army. It wasn't very difficult. They occupied Iran, and then the U.S. joined shortly thereafter. And then this was the first major interaction between ordinary Americans and ordinary Iranians. We had 30,000 American GIs stationed across Iran along the Trans-Iranian Railway, getting lend-lease supplies up from the British positions in the Persian Gulf up to the Soviet Union. It's actually a critical operation. It really made a significant difference in the war, but it is one of the most sort of unknown episodes. It was very secretive at the time, but it made a real difference. And it was, you know, as I said, with 30,000 Americans in Iran, suddenly you had real contact between the two populations. It wasn't always a pretty sight. Sometimes the American soldiers would stagger around kind of drinking or going to brothels and so on. But, you know, it was the first real interaction.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Did you see anything come from this? Because, you know, historians have talked about the Crusades, that for all the violence, it led to a reawakening of contact between the Middle East and the Mediterranean world, laying the groundwork for education or ancient sources coming from the Middle East translated into Latin and the Renaissance and other things like that due to this initial contact? And do you see anything coming from this contact of tens of thousands of GIs in Iranian culture?
Not anything terribly positive, to be honest. It was, there were a lot of, my own father has told me stories of, growing up around that time. And, if you left your window open on a hot summer's night, you could hear these American soldiers fornicating in the rocks, in the distance, in movie theaters or so on. It wasn't a particularly edifying spectacle, to be quite honest with you. There were a lot of incidents of American GIs driving their jeeps too fast through small towns and killing pedestrians and so on. And there was a lot of tension around this kind of stuff. But I think the big thing that came out of it is it forced the U.S. officially into a kind of position vis-a-vis Iran that it never had, which is that FDR felt very idealistically that he was concerned about what would happen after the end of the war. He didn't want the British and the Soviets to because they were longstanding rivals in Iran, and they didn't want them to start a new war over Iran when the Second World War was over. And he pushed, the U.S. actually pushed the three allies to clarify their positions and respect Iranian sovereignty. And under the tripartite agreement, agreed that they would vacate their troops within 6 months of the end of the war, which was a relatively positive move for the U.S., I think, to make towards Iran. However, it also initiated, after the war, Roosevelt had this idealistic idea that the U.S. should send major advisory missions to Iran, large-scale advisory missions, the idea was to help Iran stand on its own feet so that the British and the Soviets wouldn't try to take advantage and initiate a new war or destabilization in Iran. But what it meant was that this was the first large-scale official American interaction with Iran. You had these three big missions, one of them a military mission, an armory advisory mission called Armish Mag that ended up becoming the largest U.S. military advisory mission in the world during the Cold War, the early Cold War. There was a gendarmerie mission, a national police mission led by General Norman Schwarzkopf, Sr., the father of the Stormin Norman Schwarzkopf. And then there was a financial mission led by Arthur Millspaugh to reorganize Iran's finances and so on. These were not always very popular missions, but this was the first time the U.S. became deeply entrenched and involved with the regime of the last Shah of Iran.
Now we're getting to a point where if listeners have more the mainstream knowledge of Iran, getting to the CIA overthrow in 1953, as you said. So what happens? It sounds like for generations, relations between the United States and Iran are positive. If only they like the idea of each other, that the United States liked the idea of Iran as this magnanimous influence in the Middle East that has a thousand-year storied history of protecting people, stories from the Old Testament. Iran likes the idea of the United States, and the contacts that they do have with each other seem to be fairly positive, albeit a few speeding tickets here or there. And then we get to the 1950s, and this lays the groundwork for the two becoming bitter, despised enemies, where Iran is labeled part of the axis of evil and everything else. So based on the historical context you provided, how would you describe the CIA overthrow of the government?
Yeah, I mean, this is a history that I think we're now getting to a terrain that may be more well known to some of your listeners. But this was when everything changed. It was obviously in 1953 when the CIA overthrew gave its backing to a coup that overthrew the prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh. Mossadegh was a very popular prime minister, especially among the young, liberal, nationalistic middle classes, educated middle classes, the very people who were most naturally inclined to be pro-American and were, in many cases, very pro-American, were the very people who became completely disillusioned by the United States after this action. Mossadegh was their hero. He really stood up for Iran in a way that no Iranian politician had really done before, in a very modern way, in a very populist kind of way, did nationalize the Iranian oil industry, which had been in the hands of the British oil company, Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which later became British Petroleum or BP. This was the big watershed. But it's funny, like what I'm always interested in is that even right up until this coup, there was still an overwhelmingly pro-American kind of atmosphere in Iran, even among the most diehard supporters of Mossadegh. Mossadegh himself was passionately not anti-American. This is the thing. He was nationalistic in a sort of third worldist sort of way. He was a liberal. He was by no means any kind of socialist or socialist sympathizer, but he was a progressive nationalist. And he himself was a great admirer of the U.S. And this is one of the things, I mentioned Morgan Schuster earlier, this American financial advisor that was very popular in Iran. Mossadegh in the 1920s, he really admired Schuster like everyone else. And he said, I love America and Americans, but I don't think we should have everyone wanted to bring Schuster back to the U.S., to Iran, to because they liked him so much. But he said, no, you know, we have to organize our own finances. He said, you know, a nation that cannot stand on its own feet is a nation that is not worthy of surviving, you know, and that was his very principled stance. It wasn't anti-American at all, actually. In fact, even when he tussled with Arthur Millspaugh, who was kind of Schuster's successor as financial advisor in the 1940s, you know, he would say in his parliamentary speeches, you know, I'm sure that the great American people would not want to see one of their own behaving in this way in Iran. You know, he was always very disappointed with the U.S. rather than angry. And in fact, you could see this, the same tone in some of the nationalist newspapers that supported Mossadegh in the early 1950s. I mean, I've read some of these newspapers, and when they criticize the U.S., it's so interesting. It's so different from the way they criticize Britain, for example. You know, they say, you know, the U.S. is, maybe the U.S. is inexperienced. Maybe it doesn't know what it's doing. It hasn't tasted what it's like to be a kind of major power for very long. You know, maybe it's being misled and manipulated by the British. You know, it's not adhering to its own principles. That's so different from the way they talked about Britain, which was the kind of the evil empire at the time. You know, they really were disappointed and almost saddened to see the U.S. not living up to its principles. Just 3 weeks before Mossadegh was overthrown by the CIA, the last person he wrote a letter to was Eisenhower, because he was being pressured by the British with sanctions and embargoes and financial penalties and so on. And he wrote to Eisenhower asking for money to help keep the government afloat. That says so much, right? This is, you know, right down to the end, he felt that the one country that would understand Iran's plight would be the U.S., not knowing that, at that very moment that his letter arrived in Washington, Eisenhower had already given his authorization to Operation Ajax, to the coup that would overthrow him. That is the atmosphere in which, that's how much changed in 1953, right?
Now, I'm ignorant on this topic, I'll admit, and was it purely Cold War calculus that causes the United States to support the overthrow of his government?
So I don't think it's, not that you're ignorant, actually. I think this is something that historians really debate. I can tell you my own view is that I think, yes, that's I think it was a straightforward Cold War kind of calculation. I do not believe this was about oil. I know a lot of people like to see things that way. I'm not really a materialist historian, but I also think that just the facts are pretty simple. Like the U.S. had more than enough oil in the early 1950s. That wasn't an imperative. It wasn't worried about its oil supply or the price of oil, which was quite low at the time. They weren't trying to save the British oil company. That wasn't, in fact, if anything, the American oil companies had a real rivalry with the British oil companies in the early 20th century. And they were not trying, this wasn't, you know, something that the American oil companies particularly supported either. It was really that the British did a very good job of convincing the new incoming Republican administration that Iran was becoming destabilized by Mossadegh, that Iran was not ready for democracy in the way that Mossadegh wanted, and that the Soviets were going to take advantage of that to destabilize the country and bring about a Soviet coup, a pro-Soviet coup. The irony is that wasn't likely. The only reason, if that was even going to happen, it was precisely because the British were actually destabilizing Iran, and they were actually creating the conditions for that situation. And the evidence is pretty clear about that. But they created a sort of self-fulfilling situation where they could go to the U.S. and say, you know, we were worried about Iran. We're worried about the Soviets in Iran. And as you know, in 1952, 53, the Republicans had been out of power in Washington for 20 years, and they had come to power in a very sort of anti-communist kind of wave. And that was really what dominated their thinking. And so the British were very good at convincing them along those lines.
In the 4 or 5 bullet points that most people know about Iran, one of them is that they'll connect the coup to the 1979 Islamic Revolution, that people there are still smarting in Iran over the coup or the. And because of that, Ayatollah Khomeini is the vessel by which they think their frustration or angst or wanting to remove the Shah from power is best expressed, and that leads to the revolution. I'm describing the conventional wisdom of Iran, but what do you think is important to understand for the Islamic Revolution of 1979, that in the context of this larger history that you've been describing?
That conventional wisdom is not inaccurate. I mean, that's largely right. I mean, the 1979 revolution was, at least in terms of U.S.-Iran relations, and the hostage crisis was very much a backlash to 1953. You know, it's very clear from their memoirs and so on. The students that took the embassy hostage in 1979 were worried more than anything about the idea that the embassy was going to get used again to bring about another coup, just as it happened 25 years earlier. I mean, this was a generation that, in even some of the Islamic revolutionary authorities, this was a generation that had come of age in 1953, idealistic young people back then who had rallied around Mossadegh and oil nationalization, and found, much to their surprise, that their dreams had been dashed by a coup that had been plotted and launched from the bowels of the U.S. embassy in Tehran. So naturally, 25 years later, they were very careful about that. And they were actually paranoid about the role that the U.S. embassy would play. And so when the U.S. admitted the Shah for medical treatment in October 1979, they thought, here we go again. They're going to do this again. And that was really the sort of the neuralgic approach that they had to the role of the U.S. embassy and what it was like an asset that they felt they had to kind of lock down to make sure that they weren't going to get, you know, sort of fool me twice, fool me once, you know, shame on you, but, you know, fool me twice, shame on me. And that was the mentality. However, I think it's important to recognize that the Iranian revolution itself was not an inherently anti-American revolution, at least initially. The Iranian people did not rise up against their Shah because they were angry with the U.S. They rose up against their Shah because they were angry with the Shah and they wanted his regime gone, you know, for many reasons. So both, and this was, the opposition to the Shah came from all directions by the 1970s, from Islamists, radical religious Islamists, from leftists, very, very actively, from leftists, Maoists, you know, leftist militias, guerrilla groups, and from centrist liberal nationalists, the old people, the people who had supported Mossadegh 25 years earlier. You know, the irony was all three of these groups were angry with the Shah for different reasons, but all three of them were also angry with the U.S. for different reasons. And that was a really potent mix. The radical religious, increasingly radical religious elements obviously saw the U.S. as the embodiment of kind of Western decadence and imperialism in the Muslim world. The leftists, of course, you know, this is the middle of the Cold War, are obviously going to be anti-American for reasons that are fairly obvious, you know, but the left in Iran had moved from, you know, the sort of institutional Tudeh party, the sort of pro-Soviet, pro-Russian party to these more sort of Maoist-inspired guerrilla groups that were more anti-American and more radical. But the irony is the one group that could have held all of this together, the middle, the liberals, the nationalists, they were the ones that could have, I think, under normal circumstances, maybe held the middle. But they had their own reasons for being angry with the United States because the United States had overthrown their beloved leader 25 years earlier. These were people who felt by the late 1970s, you know, we did everything by your rules. We did everything in this sort of quote unquote Western way. We had newspapers, petitions, political parties. We tried to build democracy, and the world's greatest democracy ended up overthrowing our leader. So there was a feeling that, you know, the hell with it. That doesn't work anymore. And so there was this atmosphere of radicalization. And then, of course, the Shah's regime was so repressive by the late 1970s that there was simply no avenue for opposition activism. And when the Shah began to liberalize a little bit around 1976, 77, 78, the lid just came off and it was too late.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Well, that brings us to contemporary issues. And of course, any kind of diplomatic interaction with the United States and Iran always seems to be revolve around nuclear issues or averting a war. Early in 2020 with Qasem Soleimani, his killing, everything seems to be framed in a negative way. But for you as a historian, I would imagine you're trying to frame contemporary issues in light of this long history. And the question is what happens next, but I just want to insert a little aside here. And that is that I've had interactions with Iranians over the years living in Turkey. And then I took a year of Persian studying it. And nobody in Turkey, among Turks, but definitely among Iranians, they may have wanted to argue about the merits of the Iraq War, but not a single person was ever rude to me just because of being an American. Not only that, but when I mentioned I took, you know, a Persian course and I knew about the poet Saadi and I had read the Gulistan, people's eyes would light up and I think I'm about to be invited into their home as an honored guest. And the level of hospitality and warmth among Iranian people, at least in my personal experiences, I think I would put it number one in my leaderboard of encountering people. So despite generations of politics that's been very ugly and acrimonious between the United States and Iran, at least among the personal encounters I had, it's as if that hasn't happened. The only people who've ever been rude to me are Western Europeans, just for on account of being American. So there you go. But so in light of this long history between the United States and Iran, do you have any sense about the future?
Yeah, I think what you describe is something that I hear again and again and again. I mean, all the time, almost unanimously among Americans who have traveled to Iran, for example, are just absolutely amazed and blown away, really, by how hospitable people are to them and how excited people in Iran are to see Americans. People, especially like yourself, who have traveled or lived a lot in the Middle East, especially when they go to Iran, are really struck uniformly, universally, by the fact they feel more welcome and more safe in Iran than they do anywhere else in the Middle East. And that's a real surprise. I think there are, you know, a lot of different reasons for this. I mean, I think that to some extent, when you have a government that is institutionally anti-American, your population is perhaps, you know, more likely, less likely to be anti-American. You know, I think that in countries where people perceive their leaders perhaps as being, you know, sort of vassals of American foreign policy, you know, you do have, you know, when you have resentment against the government, then naturally it often sometimes tips over into, you know, anti-Americanism as well. And you see this in places like Pakistan or Egypt or so on. I think that's part of it. But I also think largely, you know, Iranians, they like Americans as people. They go out of their way to say that, you know, we have no problem with the American people, we have issues with American foreign policy. And the government takes that stance as well. I mean, you know, but I think also, you know, obviously Middle Eastern, you know, Iranian hospitality, Middle Eastern hospitality is pretty legendary as well. You know, I always encourage Americans to visit Iran. It's a wonderful place to go as a tourist. It's not as difficult to travel there as you might think. It's just a little bit difficult to get a visa, but you can go with tour groups and so on. And there's a lot of great things about traveling there, which is, you know, it's cheap. There are not a lot of tourists. And there are some amazing historical sites that you pretty much have all to yourself. You know, maybe you share it with a few small groups of European tourists and Japanese tourists. But, you know, actually, it's a really lovely place to travel. But yeah, look, on the people-to-people level, this has always been a relatively pleasant relationship. There have been difficult times, of course, during the hostage crisis. There was a lot of anti-Iranian sentiment in the U.S., you know, but, you know, on the whole, I think a lot of time has now passed since those revolutionary days. And I think, you know, feelings have calmed quite a bit. And if anything, you know, I think the Iranian public is one of the most pro-American publics in the region, actually.
Well, anything else that you'd like to highlight in this history? Because the name of your book is America and Iran, A History 1720 to the Present. Looking at this long history, are there any other things you think it's helpful for people to understand?
Yeah, I mean, so much. But I mean, I think really, again, I would just go back to, you know, the importance of looking at history as a, you know, in the long term and recognizing just how warm and positive this relationship has been and how it really could be that way again. I believe that. Obviously, as a historian, I'm more comfortable in the past than I am in making predictions about the future. I'm pretty comfortable predicting that we're not going to wake up tomorrow and find that the U.S. and Iran have become, you know, best friends. But I do think that there's no reason why that couldn't, why some kind of friendship or alliance couldn't take place within our lifetimes. The logic of some of those early encounters is still there. Unfortunately, politics gets in the way, but politics has a way of changing unpredictably. You know, yeah, so we never know where things could end up. So I'm not optimistic, but I am idealistic when I think of U.S.-Iran relations.
All right. So for listeners who want to dive more into the story, and I really think it is good to know just because so many people lack familiarity with it. And looking at those aspects of history, I think paint in the corners of the bigger picture really well. And the name of the book is American Iran, A History 1720 to the Present. John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for the conversation.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, But you also get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.